It's 8:11 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Summit County Council met yesterday. On the phone with a recap, I have Councilmember Doug Clyde. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning.
So you got a briefing on the e-bike program from the vendors at Bewegan, the company that builds the bikes and installed
right.
them.
That's the system, yeah.
Yeah. So have you ridden an e-bike, and what was your experience?
Well, I did, and the experience was delightful, and the bikes worked very well. Because I don't live on that side of the county, I've had limited opportunity to follow up since the initial ride, however.
Yeah. And what's your sense? I mean, are people riding them just for something to do, or are people riding them to get out of their cars?
I think the answer is both. It's certainly in and of itself, it's an interesting attraction, right? You make this thing available at the bus stops. People get off the bus, they look at them, and they say, "Gee, I can ride this electric assist bike. I've never seen an electric assist bike. This is interesting. These are the mountains. It's wonderful out here. Let's do it." Other people, I believe, are using them for actual reduction of car trips.
Yeah. So for next season, they'll be making, I'm guessing, improvements in terms of the staff, the equipment available, and the ability to make kind of on-the-spot repairs?
Yeah, that was, we had a, we have a performance-based contract with Bewegan, and I think it's fair to say that they did not meet their availability criteria, and last night what you heard was that they were very contrite about that and offered to us numerous ways in which they were going to make sure that they were living up to their contract.
Yeah. According to some of the comments you received, there were people taking the e-bikes off onto the off-road trails. Also, you had some cases of parents signing up for the bikes and putting their kids on them. So anything
yeah.
we can do to stop that?
The off-road trail issue was one that I think also contributed to the problem of the durability and availability of the bikes. Although the bikes are designed for a commercial use, they probably did not have Summit County mountain bike trails in mind when they put the bike together. There is a possibility that they will prevent the bikes from operating once they get outside of our trail and traffic network. In other words, they can define an area such as the mountains, and they can simply shut the bike off if you get out of that area. The other question about what do you do about underage people running the bikes, I think that is an issue that we're not going to be able to enforce. That's a matter of parents making decisions for their children.
Yeah. In terms of next year increasing, we're talking about doubling the number of bikes?
Yeah. The commitment that they made, or the number of bikes that we installed, was about, for this year, for the beginning season, was about half of what they thought the demand would accommodate. So we started with probably a few less bikes, substantially less bikes, actually, than we probably should have. And that was manifest in the operation of the system. I mean, the bikes were gone immediately.
Yeah, and I was going to say, is there a way to improve the system, to be able to find out where available bikes are?
Yeah, there's it's a complicated deal, right? You have bikes that are packed full of electronics that are communicating to the master system about their location and about their status, and so there are numerous ways that that things can go wrong. And one of the things that we found was that the program was not keeping very good track of where the bikes were. They believe they have that problem solved and that they will be able to produce something in the order of 90% accuracy in that going forward.
All right. Moving on to the Weber Basin Water District, you recommending that David Ure continue to represent Summit County on that board. How come?
A variety of issues. Certainly, David's commitment and past experience with Summit County. Obviously, you know, he was a past council person and a legislator, and lives in Summit County, and so we believe he has our best interest at heart. He, you know, is also chairman of the Trust Schools Lands, and so is dealing with water and land issues all the time. And for that reason, we felt that his continued presence on the board was in our best interest.
All right. Moving on to the Canyons Resort Spa Plan. The hearing drew about 15 people. Nobody was there to talk about the resort core, the way we measure heights of the buildings or anything. The comments were about the lower part of Canyons Resort near Highway 224, where we plan to expand the road from two lanes to five. Some residents there on the north side of the road, like the Hidden Creek development, are concerned about the impact. So we know that there's room for five lanes?
We don't. That was the question that was posed last night, was we have a conceptual plan put forward by the proponents, that is the Canyons traffic engineer. We have looked at that plan, but we have not analyzed it in terms of pedestrian and golf cart access across that road. So that's one of the things that we're going to be looking at.
All right. Also, a lot of detailed discussion about, is it going to be safe? And do we need to change those plans or tweak them?
Well, again, those are all items that we're going to expect a lot more info on. As I say, that drawing that they presented to us last night was a conceptual drawing of five lanes with a golf cart path across it, but no crossing path for what we know to be the historic foot traffic that comes from the north and crosses over to the gondola, to the cabriolet.
Yeah. A representative from the Escala development asked you to delay approval until they can work out an access issue with the applicant TCFC. You commented about this. Is it the county's issue?
Well, that's precisely it. You know, we have to be careful when we're making these sort of approvals to confine our action to the item that is on the table. The Escala people were talking about ski run improvements that may or may not take place in the future. That's not our job. You know, if they're able to work out with something with Escala, that's great. Their plan does not live or die based on that. The only thing that we're acting upon is the reconfiguration of the buildings in the village core and the height of those buildings.
You had taken a field trip to the Red Pine Road earlier in the day. What was that for?
Well, it was to look at the site from the perspective of height. Height was one of the major issues. Oh, while we received no comment on it last night, it was one of the major issues that the Planning Commission dealt with. And so we're being asked to pass on that. And so it was important for us to get out in the field and stand where those buildings were and understand how tall they were going to be and how they were going to affect the base of the village.
So when's the next meeting on the spa?
I'm going to be challenged by the calendar, but we were continued to the public hearing was continued to our next meeting, which is in our next meeting in Colville, and I can't give you the date right off the top of my head.
Okay, well, I'm guessing it's not the 22nd. There's the 15th and maybe the 29th. So yeah. This month, you think later this month? We're talking December.
I'm sorry, Leslie. Okay. I did not write down the date in which we continue that for.
All right. Well, are you ready to vote on this?
No, I'm not ready to vote. There are a couple issues out there that that may or may not be material, and we just need to look into that. And one of them certainly is the issue of pedestrian safety down on the main road. And the other is a rather complicated issue having to do with what the purpose of Red Pine Road was. There's a plat note that has surfaced that provides some question about whether Red Pine Road can be used to access some of the parcels that they want to access.
All right. Let's see. During public comment, The county council heard from Jan Perkins from South Summit, who has often spoken out about discouraging sprawl on the east side. She opposes densities of 1 unit per 5 acres, even 1 unit per 10. In fact, she urged the council to support no more than 1 unit per 40, saying that this will encourage development to go into cities. So what's your take on that, Doug?
This is not an item that the council has come to any firm conclusion on as of yet. We've had a few public hearings about this. The council is, I think, it would be fair to say, is very concerned about the information that we've had from the health department as well as transportation, et cetera, about what the impacts of the one-acre zoning would be, the expansion of that. We have yet to get into the issue of whether 5 acre is good, 6 acre is good, 10 acre is good, 20 acre is good. We haven't begun that discussion yet, but we greatly appreciated Jan's input.
Yeah, she also mentioned the impacts of growth on water and sewer infrastructure, and I believe, Doug, you also brought that up when you were on the East County Planning Commission, yeah?
Yeah, that's always been my concern, and I believe that it is one of the problems that has made this such a long and difficult process for the county council, is that in the recommendations that were forwarded to us by Planning Commission, there was no accounting for what the impacts would be on traffic or water quality or water quantity or wetlands or various other things that really is at the heart of our responsibility when we apply zoning regulations.
Okay. Hey, I just wanted to kind of get your take with regard to the back and forth over the Oscarthorpe Ranch property. Is this going to be settled, do you think? I mean, are we going to be able to acquire that?
Well, the question is we, and to the extent that Summit County is included, the answer is to how much. The difficulty that was encountered was that in some of the original discussions that we had with them, we had proposed some off-site trail improvements on 224 and some open space concessions on 224 in the parcel that runs to the south of the golf course and to the north of the Catholic Church. And those were part, those along with some public easements around the Oscarthorpe parcel were part of our original discussions and where we came up with a number that was $4 million, $4.1 or whatever. Since then, the majority of that public benefit has been taken off the table. And so that leaves us in a place where we have limited funds that are available for that sort of acquisition. The county does not have monies for the purpose of ag preservation on the Snyderville side. We have monies for open space and recreation. We don't have monies that are for ag preservation.
So while we're arguing between the council, the Summit Land Conservancy, and the Oscarthorpe family, are we letting the property slip away from us?
I don't think that that's in our control. Again, our monies are strictly limited. If they don't offer up enough public benefit in the terms of recreation, et cetera, then we simply don't have monies to use, nor would it be responsible for us to use the public monies in that fashion. You know, we're involved in a lot of open space acquisitions. We're very concerned about how much we pay for that. We're very concerned about whether the public is getting a good deal for that money. That's money that they voted on in a bond. And, you know, initially on a per-acre basis, the problem with the Oscarthorpe deal was that it completely blew our budget in terms of what we typically pay for open space.
All right. Finally, we just wanted to ask you, there's a legislative meeting later this afternoon with our state representatives and senators. Any issues in particular that you want to discuss with them?
Well, I don't have a laundry list. You know, our list with the state almost inevitably concerns pending legislation, and this is an interesting year because the because it is an election year for some of the state representatives. There is a lot of talk about legislation, but our lobbyist, at least, is telling us that there actually probably won't be a lot of legislation because most of the senators will want to stay clear of controversial items. So I don't know that we have anything hot on our list right now. You know, we're looking for always looking for help and assistance with transportation, transit, roadway improvements, water quality, all of those issues. So those will all be of concern.
All right. Anything else, Doug, you wanted to mention?
I think that's it, Leslie. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for your time. Joining me now in the studio, the chairman of the Park City Planning Commission, Adam Strong. Good morning.
Good morning.
So let's see. You asked last night for a second meeting with the applicant December 6th, and the plan is to, what, make a decision on the 13th?
That's the plan, yeah.
You guys ready?
I think so. I think we're getting pretty close. We'll get a few more submittals from both staff and from the applicant, but yeah, we're pretty close.
Yeah, Pat Sweeney told me last week that he didn't think he needed to ask for a decision that would kick that 45-day time frame to make a decision. So that's your understanding as well. We've come to the end of the process here, huh?
That's yeah.
Mm-hmm. Last night you had asked the applicant's attorney, Sean Farron, how much the commission should rely on the Woodruff drawings and in which they should refer to them. So what's the answer to that?
Well, I unfortunately didn't get a very clear answer, at least not one that I understood, but I'm going to go back and look at the minutes and kind of parse carefully Mr. Farron's words. But unfortunately, it's hard for us to tell from the applicant's perspective when we're supposed to rely on those drawings and when we're not supposed to rely on them. I think it's fair to say the applicant thinks that we're supposed to rely on the drawings to figure out, in their words, basic volumetrics, i.e. whether the amount of UEs assigned to the project can fit within the structures that are drawn in the Woodruff drawings. And that may be a bare minimum that the drawings are useful for. There may be more use for them, but I'm just going to have to, and the rest of the commissioners will be doing the same, go back and look and see.
So UEs meaning unit equivalents.
Yeah, thanks.
You know, and there's been lots of discussion about these drawings and what purpose they serve. I mean, why not just ask the person who developed them rather than second-guessing what they mean?
Well, the person who developed them is not, you know, somebody readily available, and they are, like many of the other documents that make up the MPD, they're not the entire thing. So you can't look at them in isolation and say, okay, well, we've got the Woodruff drawings, we'll just approve that much, and decision's made. I mean, the MPD document is big, and it's got lots of attachments, and the Woodruff drawings are one of them, but there are other factors that have to go into the analysis.
Yeah, so for months, the Planning Commission has been saying they need more details from the Sweeneys. You now are telling me, though, you have enough information and details to make a decision.
Well, I'm not necessarily saying that we have enough details. I'm saying we're close to ready to make a decision. The absence of detail may play into our decision, but it has become clear that the applicant is going to rest on the submittals that they've made. And although some may think they're deficient, the applicant does not think they're deficient, so they're going to rest on them and see what the decision is.
Yeah, and what Pat Sweeney told me last week is that never has the Planning Commission required such detail from any conditional use permit request. So are we treating this one differently?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, first of all, the project itself is different. It's unique, and I think the applicant readily admits that and did so last night. I mean, we've got a large amount of square footage going up inside the historic district of Old Town. which immediately sets it apart from any other CUP that we've ever dealt with. So, yes, we treat it the same, i.e. we run it through the 15 criteria of the LMC, Land Management Code, but we also look at its impacts differently because it's a different project with different square footages in a different place. So we treat it the same, but the outcome may not be the same.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's kind of goes to the point yesterday is that we're talking about things became a little bit touchy when Commissioner Steve Joyce asked about the applicant's comment about the drawings being conceptual only. That's what they say they are. I mean, the details come much later when they go through the master planning process.
Well, the details are supposed to come out during the CUP process. The master plan process back in the 80s only resulted in the Woodruff drawings, and the applicant, you're right, does contend that they are just conceptual. You know, Commissioner Joyce and I think others on the commission think that they're more than conceptual. They give the Planning Commission a pretty good idea of the direction that the original MPD approvers thought the project would take. So, you know, we're somewhere in between, and that's kind of where December 13th is going to take us, is we're going to have to, you know, figure out exactly what those drawings mean and what the reasonable size of the project will be.
Treasurer Attorney Sean Farron told the Planning Commission that in the past year and a half, the applicant has submitted 10 position statements with detailed analysis about the CUP criteria, the compliance, the impacts of the project, detailed mitigation of those impacts. He says that those documents are critical to the process and tell the whole story. They're also long and detailed, but he said you have to read them. And my guess is that you have read them, but is the rest of the Planning Commission just relying on the staff reports, or have they dug deep into these?
No. And Commissioner Susser actually took exception to Mr. Farron's comment. I'm not sure Mr. Farron meant it to mean that we hadn't read the position papers. I think he was trying to reiterate that, you know, as we get here close to decision time, we need to review those position papers. But the commissioners have read them. I've read them. They are detailed. They are lengthy. And they are helpful. But it's not as though we have blindly just looked at the staff report and all of our comments have been based on those reports alone. That's just not accurate.
And you also asked last night Think Attorney Nikki DeForge to go through her analysis of an Exhibit 1 dealing with some kind of deed, asking her why she thinks it doesn't permit removal of excavated materials in the recreation open space. How come?
Well, it takes a little bit of explanation. I'll try to make it as quick as I can. So one of the issues we've had, of course, is the applicant wants to put nearly 800,000 cubic yards of excavated material up above the project on the ski runs and area known as the Creole Gulch and King's Crown Run and so forth. Originally, there was going to be a conveyor belt system that would take that up, but now the applicant has decided to truck it up. There's two questions that arise from that. One, can they do that within the building area boundary? Can they do that outside of the building area boundary? And two, more to your question, do the documents attached to the MPD allow that? And the applicant in their position paper that they submitted, which we read, had an exhibit to that, Exhibit A, which was a grant deed from the Sweeneys and another partner, the Bouliots, but I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, to the city. And an exception in that grant deed gave the Sweeneys the right to put what is termed, quote, excess fill up on the open space parcel. So the question I had for Ms. DeForge was, how does she interpret the term excess fill, and how do you differentiate between that and the word fill? Because in at least my initial reading of that, I'm not sure that it envisions all of the fill or even a vast majority of the fill being deposited on the area above the project. It may allow some amount of fill. Unfortunately, the document doesn't say exactly what amount. But I just wanted her take on how to interpret that document. And she was very helpful. And I'll again be going back and looking at the minutes on what she said.
Yeah. So Sweeney, though, says that there is precedent for excavating like that. And he pointed to the work that was done prior to the 2002 Olympics and again later to kind of move all of that dirt around there at the base for the superpipe. So how was this any different than what's already been done?
I didn't hear him talk about those two examples, but you know, I think the cuts out of the side of the mountain down at the Olympic Park will be somewhat similar to the cuts we're talking about here. So I guess there is a comparison there. But, you know, that's a different place with not a residential surrounding around it and for a different purpose and under a different code. So those are different things. In terms of the superpipe, I think the comparison is just one of magnitude. I mean, the amount, I don't know how many cubic yards were removed to build the superpipe, but I doubt it was 800,000 cubic yards. So I think that's a question of magnitude. So I guess without knowing more, that's what I'd say.
All right. So what's next? Just the November 29th meeting, then the December 6th, and then a decision on the 13th.
Yeah, I think the applicant expects to have their final or close to final things in on the 29th. The December 6th meeting will likely take the form of a work session with the planning commissioners and staff sitting down and kind of doing the grunt work of going through everything and trying to get our hands around everything as a group. And then the last meeting on December 13th will be the decision one.
And that'll be your final meeting?
That'll be my final meeting, I hope.
Okay. Anything else, Adam, noteworthy from last night's meeting?
Nope.
Okay. Hey, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
8:42, good morning. Well, Utah's new net metering changes will start November 15th, and that means if you've been considering solar, now's the time to commit. On the phone to explain is Kate Bowman. She's the project manager with Utah Clean Energy. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
So just give us a bit of background, if you would. What's changing and why?
Well, this has been a long process, but what's changing is the way that someone who has solar on their rooftop is compensated for the electricity that they send to the grid. And so for a long time now, for years in Utah, when you send electricity out to the grid as a solar customer, you get a kilowatt hour credit that you can redeem later, sort of like rollover minutes on a cell phone. And what's changing is the value of that credit when you export solar out to the grid and how you're compensated for it.
So how is that going to change then?
They're going to get... November 15th, anyone who fills out an interconnection agreement on November 15th, so that means you actually apply with the utility to connect a solar array to the grid. You don't actually have to install it on that date. Anyone who applies starting November 15th going forward is going to receive a slightly lower credit value for the electricity that you send to the grid. So you'll receive 9.2 cents for every kilowatt hour that you export out to the grid. And for comparison purposes, the average electricity price for a residential customer for a home is 10.2 cents. So it's a slight reduction compared to what you're paying for electricity.
Right. And this was done as a way to kind of appease Rocky Mountain Power, who said that solar customers were not paying their fair share for the grid itself.
Exactly. This was a settlement that was facilitated by the Utah Governor's Office of Energy Development and brought together the utility, Rocky Mountain Power, who had been proposing for several years additional fees and charges for solar customers, and brought the utility together with groups like Utah Clean Energy and with the solar industry to really take a hard look at this issue and think about, you know, what's a solution that we can agree to that will preserve the solar market in Utah and make it so people who are interested in going solar have some certainty about what to expect in the future and have a way to export their electricity to the grid and to get credits for it.
All right. So, again, as we've talked about, the current rate ends Tuesday. So what has to happen before that? A contract is signed with a solar company or the interconnection application signed with Rocky Mountain Power?
Actually, all you have to do before Tuesday to be grandfathered into the net metering program, and it's by midnight on November 14th, you have to file an interconnection application with Rocky Mountain Power, and it has to be complete. So you can't miss any information. You can't go back and change it later necessarily. So you have to file that complete interconnection application with Rocky Mountain Power. You don't actually have to sign a contract. You don't have to get the system installed. Once you file that interconnection application, you have 1 year to get your system installed. So you don't need to rush to actually get the panels on your roof, but it is very important to get that interconnection application submitted by the end of the day on the 14th of November.
All right. So where are these applications available?
They're available on Rocky Mountain Power's website, and they're not something that most people will be able to fill out entirely on your own. You will have to work with an installer. So a good way to start is by contacting a solar installer, and they're very familiar with this application and with the deadline, and a solar installer will be able to help you fill it out and get it completed and submitted.
And again, even if you sign, you are not committed to anything, right?
You're not committed to installing. You still have a year to decide, you know, whether you want to install or not, and you could choose not to if you want to, but it just reserves your spot to be able to be part of the net metering program.
Okay, so that's the case. If something should happen financially between now and before you had to install, you would still be able to just back out. It would just, I guess, just void the application, huh?
Exactly. You could back out. You could put it off to a later date. And something that's important to know for people who are interested in going solar and maybe now just isn't quite the right time is that under the new program, which begins on November 15th, and it's called the Transition Program, you will still see a similar payback to what you would under the current net metering program. You'll probably see it'll probably be a slightly longer payback compared to if you were able to get that application in sooner. So if you're ready to go, it's definitely a good idea. But don't rule out solar just because you're not able to get that application in time or you're not quite ready to go solar. You'll still, if you install after November 15th, you'll be part of what's called the transition program where you will get this reduced rate for the credits that you're exporting, but you can still produce power and use it on site at your own home. And you'll still likely see a reasonable return on your investment. And you'll be guaranteed those prices until January 1, 2033. So you'll have some certainty about what to expect. And just because you're not ready to go solar right now doesn't mean you shouldn't keep thinking about it and talk to some solar installers.
So after that transition program, there would be perhaps even future reductions?
It's hard to say. We really don't know what will happen after the transition program. There's actually a cap on the amount of solar that can be installed through the transition program. And for the residential customer class, it's 170 megawatts. And our estimate is that that's about 25,000, 26,000 homes. So there's a lot of room for homes to install solar under the transition program. But once we hit that cap, then solar customers from that point going forward will be on a new, different type of rate. And that rate's yet to be determined. There's going to be a proceeding before the Public Service Commission to figure out what that rate is. But in a few years, we will, anyone who applies to install solar after we hit that cap on the transition program will be part of a new rate structure that is to be determined.
Okay. So here in Summit County, we had seen a couple of opportunities for some bulk buys for solar installations. Are those pretty much gone? You would just be working with, on your own with a solar installer now?
I don't know of any programs that are bulk buy programs that are available currently. And, you know, those programs did a lot to jumpstart the market when solar was still this new, strange thing, and a lot of people didn't know how it worked. And we've seen things change a lot in the last few years, and I think solar is something that people are now, you're more likely to talk to your friends and neighbors about it or know someone who has solar. I think it's kind of a bigger part of the community, and Summit County and Park City now both have aggressive clean energy goals for the community. So I think that the environment for solar has really changed to where it is easier to get the information that you need and to understand how to get started and to find a solar installer.
Okay. So if people are, again, thinking about it, this is the time to act before Tuesday.
If you're able to get your application submitted by end of November 14th, you'll get a better return on your investment.
Okay, Kate. Anything else people should know?
There's more information about the full details of the settlement. If you really want to dig into the nitty gritty details, they're available on Utah Clean Energy's website, and we have other tools and resources to help you figure out how to find a solar installer or how to learn about solar incentives. So if you're looking for that information, you can go to utahcleanenergy.org.
Okay. Thanks for your time, Kate.
Thank you.
It's Kate Bowman, a project manager again with Utah Clean Energy. You're listening to the Local News Hour on KPCW. KPCW News Time 8:54. Good morning. Well, the Youth Sports Alliance's new executive director, Emily Fisher, surviving her first Jan's Winter Welcome as director. That's the organization's biggest fundraiser, of course. She joins me now in the studio along with after-school program director, Heather Sims. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Emily, we'll start with you. How did Jan's go, Winter Welcome go?
Jan's went wonderfully. It was a great evening. Everyone had fun. And we are still crunching some numbers, but it looks like we definitely did better than last year and made over $500,000. So big night.
That's great. And again, how is that money kind of divvied up?
So it's divvied up a couple of different ways. So mostly for our member teams, the auction items that they bring in, both silent and live, they go back to that member club. And then any of the opportunity drawing tickets that are sold and credited to one of those clubs goes back to the clubs as well. And then we also have our scholarship, and the scholarship money goes directly to the Youth Sports Alliance for us to distribute to scholarship members.
Okay. And the drawing this year was the trip to Spain to see?
Yes, El Clasico in Barcelona, so Real Madrid versus Barcelona. So that really fun experience for soccer fans.
Yeah. So what was that? Just a donor gave that to YSA then?
Vail Epic Promise, they sponsor that. So the package is sponsored by them. So that's really big because then we don't have to have the cost of that taken out of those opportunity drawing sales.
Great. And in terms of the funding, it also goes to support the
Get Out and Play program. Activate, yes. And we've just had a really big sign up with, we work with the Christian Center for Operation Hope and registered 116 kids for that are scholarshiped into the ski and the ice program. And this year we had an amazing donor come forward as part of their opening. The Whole Foods actually are supplying 120 kids with clothing. And they worked with Backcountry and North Face to actually get those. And as part of their community opening this Sunday, those kids are actually going to go and get brand new jackets and pants. So thank you to them. But yeah, the program is, we're right around the corner. They're blowing snow on the mountain, and we're looking for another fun season. And so all the kids that that sign up, that some of them in this town, this is their only chance to actually get on the mountain and to see their faces as they come off. And I was just saying that last year we had a third grader who came off the mountain with this huge grin, and she's like, "I just skied on the biggest mountain." It was first time, but for her, it was everything. So we sponsor those kids, and it's thanks to all our lovely donors from Jan's and also Live PC, Give PC tomorrow.
Yeah. So is it too late for kids to sign up for the after-school programs?
No. Registration closes on December 1st, but prices do go up on November 17th. So if there are any people who are procrastinating, I would suggest they sign up at ysaparkcity.org.
All right. And so give us a rundown of what some of the programs are available. You've got of course, so, the alpine skiing.
Yeah, we've got ice skating that starts on the 17th. And actually, there are three different programs that they get to try. They try speed skating, hockey, and figure skating. Cross country, alpine skiing and snowboarding, freestyle, and also Nordic jumping. So that's for the Get Out and Play program. And then for the Activate, there are Egyptian theater and cooking classes and photography and cross country. And so they can all look up that at, on YSA Park City.
Okay. And that Activate is for the older kids at the middle school, yeah?
Yeah, that goes from 6th to 9th grade. And we do have scholarships available for those programs as well.
Okay. So you've kind of got that big, that with Jan's kind of behind you now. What are you going to be focusing on, Emily?
Yes. Well, tomorrow, live PC, give PC. So that's our big focus right now is for people to be able to give to those programs. And then just getting our winter programming off and running. And we our next round of scholarships is March 1st, and that's for any athletes who have qualified for competitions that maybe they haven't been able to afford. So that's sort of our next big thing. But right now, really focusing on the Get Out and Play, Activate, and our sports teams as we look at alumni from our programs that hopefully will make it all the way to the Olympics in Korea.
Yeah. And those March scholarships, those are what you pull out of the Steins Endowment?
The Steins Endowment, correct. Yep. And I think just one more big shout out. I have been so impressed and humbled by the community sponsors and having Whole Foods donate all of that clothing and work with Backcountry and North Face. It's really been incredible to see how generous our community can be.
Okay. Emily and Heather, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.